These are the last words in the Gospel of Matthew, words which are often referred to as the Great Commission, a name which has both parallel and perpendicular resonance with another teaching of Jesus's, often called the Great Commandment. One says to go make disciples, and the other says to love God and neighbor as yourself. Christians have long struggled to determine which one of these is the real mission. When we read the end of Matthew, we often hear only Jesus' words at the very end. That's what happens to me. It happened at 8 o'clock, happened at 10 o'clock. All I heard were Jesus' words. I didn't hear what came before. So usually we ignore the most important elements of the story. We're in such a hurry to get to the Great Commission, to hear what Jesus was telling us to do, we skip the rest. We go straight to the goods. That's what we want to know. Like the answer on a standardized test, like God won't give us a diploma if we fill the wrong bubble on the Scantron. Right? So most of the time we're thinking the right answer is those last words in Matthew, of course, right? Words which have guided many a Christian in their present age throughout history to be generous and to seek out others, to bring them into the fold. Good Christians, like Christopher Columbus, whose post-millennialist vision of faith meant that you had to get everyone saved. So, of course, you must slaughter the ones who refuse. Or a right answer which has led to other right answers, leading to other right answers, leading to still more right answers, until you finally find yourself with altar calls and a phrase like turn or burn. Right answers which have often led to such faulty actions. Even the answer itself is representative of a faulty action to a misguided question. It isn't an answer. As if our commissioning of the Great Commission was ever Jesus' true intent. Let's instead look at what our pursuit for a right answer has us miss. The 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. Here in Matthew, they don't stay in Jerusalem like they do in Luke. They go back to the ministry fields where it all began. They return to Jesus' adopted home to be reunited with him again. These remaining disciples who only see Jesus again because they heard the messenger, heard the proclamation from Mary Magdalene, a woman most trusted to deliver on a promise, a woman most capable of delivering the message of Jesus' death and resurrection to the world. There can be no great commission if Mary weren't first commissioned to proclaim the gospel. And they go there expecting what? Another chance at Rome? Another chance to just chill with Jesus and walk around some more? What did they think they'd find? When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. They worshiped him, the one who taught them to love God as the only God. And they are worshiping him like he's the one who did it, like he's some icon, or like he may be the manifestation of God. But not all of them. Some doubted. Now, Matthew is a particular gospel, more so than the others, unique here in its relationship to doubt. The other three don't do this. The writer doesn't hide that some of them didn't dig on this moment, that some were still hesitant to believe. It's not just like Thomas, who didn't see. This is eyewitness stuff, as they doubt, even as they see. The evangelist makes room for doubt, like he made room for it in the empty tomb. There he brings up the specter that these Christ followers might make up a disappearance story, that they might make it all up so that people would be fooled. You can find that at the end of chapter 27. Now, we have new page pew Bibles. If you find it on page 811, if that's your cup of tea, you can. It's right. Oh, my bookmark disappeared. There it is. The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember what that impostor said while he was still alive. After 3 days, I will rise again. Therefore, command the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may go and steal him away and tell the people he has been raised from the dead, and the last deception would be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can." So they went with the guard and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone. That the evangelist would even write that, and that scribes would leave it, given how the Bible is created, is miraculous. If you're trying to build confidence and certainty and convince everyone of this, why inject doubt? Why bring up the doubt people are already feeling? Why not just write it out of the story? You leave it in if you believe doubt is valuable, if it is the story. And that's also the same reason you have example after example of bad discipleship throughout the gospel, of disciples misunderstanding the purpose and the hope. All throughout Matthew, the evangelist gives us examples of insecurity and false bravado in the disciples. But nowhere more prominent than in those three passion predictions where Peter plays the role of Satan to tempt Jesus and prevent him from completing his mission. Or maybe the one where James and John's mom tries to get these two disciples connected to the revolution as commanders, to go down in a blaze of glory and rise to heaven as Jesus' glorious number twos. And in Matthew, this bad disciple motif is played off challenging parables constantly through the second half, which confuse and confound us to this day, like those found in chapter 25, page 806. Images of cruel masters and wicked slaves. The kind, when played as if these were allegories for God and creation, we would come to see God as a monster and creation as bad, corrupt, and perhaps even demonic, in deep contrast with what we heard from Genesis 1, when God looked at all of creation and said, "It was very good." When we read this gospel, we're reading a manual for discipleship. It's the opposite of our expectations, which is fitting, isn't it? Given what Jesus actually taught, that the upside down economy, kingdom flip dream of God would come in God's way rather than ours, looking the opposite of what we think. If you've ever read a dummy's book or IKEA instructions, you get the sense that someone is trying really hard to make this as easy on you as possible. And if you've ever written a training manual of any sort, you know how specific you have to be. You've run it by people, right? And they're like, "Huh?" Like, "I've done..." Or how precise those pictures have to be. Which direction? What does it look like? So we make that mistake and we retroject that view of a manual on our Bible. But it's nothing like that. And every time we do that, we create pain for people. We create more oppression and dysfunction. In other words, we put a stumbling block before Jesus, just like Peter. But if it's an anthology of poetry, stories, narrative nonfiction, persuasive essays, and letters, that's a manual for life which continues to speak long after we learn the right way to read them, long after we take our classes and study and hear sermons each Sunday. We can hear that in the fourth day of creation, God created days, and not go, huh? Poetry which reveals not only who God is, but who God is not. What we are to do and what we are not. And if we look at these disciples and see how they learned from Jesus, not only what, we can see our own discipleship is dependent on it, dependent on our trust and faith. Now let's jump to those last words of Jesus's. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. This isn't a throwaway line or just comforting words or some measuring stick of faith, but a promise and a reminder of who God is and what God promised. What God promised those ancestors in the desert before they escaped Egypt and before the waters parted and before they spent a generation wandering in the desert. I am. A promise of presence, always present, always with them, us. Right? But it isn't a promise only for us right now, but for future us and our children and our children's children, that God will be present then too. It is about now and about the future, because that is who God is. Right? God is here, and God will be there, howsoever God will be there. And Jesus makes that same claim, not because he thinks he's God, but because that's the very nature of God, to be in relationship. Relationship with the Godhead, with Jesus and the Spirit. Relationship with the people and the blessed community. And even relationship with us as individuals. Jesus didn't teach them things to memorize, but a way of life so they would know the way to life. To be disciples today is to be in relationship with God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, the God, the great mystery, in all the ways God has made manifest with her people. To be in relationship with one another as blessed community, children of God. And to be in relationship with our neighbors, friends, family, and even ourselves. And to be blessed like Jesus describes back in Matthew 5, in the Beatitudes, blessed to be peacemakers, shalom makers, children of God. My brothers and sisters, inheritors of the kingdom, joy, and the very grace of God, may we all heed the call to discipleship, no matter what place on that journey we find ourselves in now. May we follow Jesus in truth and hope, knowing that it is our relationships which breathe life into our bones. And may we share God's great gift of vibrant life with confident hearts of love.